You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Everyone, and welcome to the Deeper Waters podcast once again. I'm Nick Peters, your host, and I'm seeking once more to bring you the very best in Christian apologetics. And today, again, would be no exception. And I'm really excited about today's show, because we've got one of my favorites here back in the studios again. We had him on back in 2013 to talk about his book, The Lost World of Genesis 1. And I have received and read an advanced review copy of his latest book, The Lost World of Adam and Eve. Yeah, as soon as I got this one, I was just tearing right through it because, it's brilliant, okay? And the first one just really revolutionized my understanding of Genesis 1. And so our guest today, the author of The Lost World of Genesis 1, The Lost World of Adam and Eve, and the co-author of The Lost World of Scripture, and we interviewed his co-author back in 2013 also, is John Walton. Now, John Walton, according to his bio, his research and energized presentations are rooted in his passion for drawing people into a better understanding of God's self-revelation Scripture. He's got a PhD in Hebrew Union College. He's a professor of Old Testament at Wheaton College and Graduate School. He focuses his research on the literature and cultures of the ancient Near East and the Old Testament with a particular interest in Genesis. Before his role at Wheaton, John taught for 20 years at Moody Bible Institute. John has authored many articles and books, including The Lost World of Adam and Eve, The Lost World of Genesis 1, Genesis 1 as Ancient Cosmology, and Ancient Near Eastern Thought in the Old Testament. He's also served as general editor of a Zondervan Illustrated Bible Backgrounds Commentary for the Old Testament, and co-author of the IVP Bible Background Commentary, Old Testament. And his ministry experience includes church classes for all age groups, high school Bible studies, and adult Sunday school classes, as well as serving as a teacher for the Bible in 90 Days. Dr. John Walton, welcome back to the Deeper Waters podcast. It's great to have you here again.
Great to be here, Nick.
Now, that's been your history been academics there, but some people might not know much about John Walton as a person. So, who are you, and how did you get to be doing what you're doing today?
Well, when I went to college, I had no idea what I wanted to do, and I actually majored in economics and accounting, mostly because I didn't know what else to do. I had always been interested in Old Testament, but I just had not recognized there might be a career track there. And it wasn't until my junior year that I suddenly recognized that something that I loved a lot, Old Testament, was something that I could teach. And so I started going that direction. So my wife and I got married after college and went off to grad school. And I did my PhD, as you said, at Hebrew Union College. Then we moved to Moody, to Chicago, to teach at Moody, and that's when we began having a family. I have three grown children, and they're involved in all kinds of interesting things, but we don't need to spend time with that. And so that's gotten me here. It was in my doctoral program that I started getting interested in comparative studies, as I was taking Akkadian and Ugaritic and things of that sort and studying the ancient world. So I got interested in that whole area. I had always been interested in Genesis, and comparative studies is something that fits very well in the study of Genesis. And so even back in my grad school days, I was figuring that someday or other I'd write a commentary on Genesis, but I'd better start figuring out what's going on so that I could write a good commentary on it. So I've kind of spent my whole career then focusing on ancient Near East and the biblical world, and especially with Genesis, but I've done lots of other areas of research and writing as well.
I'm kind of curious what led to the fascination with the Old Testament, because for many of us in the field, when we become Christians, most of us gravitate towards the New Testament because that's where Jesus is, you know, but it is important to go to the Old Testament. What's your particular draw to the Old Testament?
You know, it happens so young that I'm not sure I understand it clearly myself. I was raised in a Christian home, was taught the Bible early and well, both in my family and in my church. And, you know, when you're taught the Bible at that age, that often means a lot of the Bible trivia, the dates and places and names. And I was taught it early, taught it well, and I knew it well. And when you're a little kid, you know, if you know something well and better than most other people around you, well, that becomes an interest. So I don't know if that was, wouldn't be the best motivation, but I don't know if that was an early one. But as a result, I just kept learning more and more about the Old Testament and was always, skilled in the content. And that made me interested in it.
You know, it's something I was thinking about earlier today, that I understand that we have many Bibles today that can be pocket Bibles that have just the New Testament, but you really miss out on so much of a Bible if all you have is the New Testament, don't you?
Yeah, I tend to think that Jesus wouldn't have liked that, just guessing, but since the scripture of his day was just the Old Testament. So the idea of missing such a large part of God's revelation of himself and being more interested in just the part that tells us how we can get to heaven, I think that is a little bit too limiting.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump into the book itself. But in order to do that, first off, we need to review a little bit of the lost world of Genesis 1. In fact, your first four propositions, at least I'd say, are kind of like rehashing the lost world of Genesis 1. So can you sum up what your basic conclusions are with Genesis 1?
Sure. I mean, I felt like I had to do that in Lost World of Adam and Eve because I couldn't assume that people reading Lost World of Adam and Eve had read Lost World of Genesis 1, and there were some basics to cover, basics about authority, basics about the ancient Near East and how it works in relationship to the Old Testament, issues about science and the Bible. So I felt like I had to kind of cover that material again to catch people up in case they hadn't read Lost World of Genesis 1. But also I wanted to do that because in the time since I did Lost World of Genesis 1, that's more than 5 years ago now, I've been on the road a lot and speaking a lot about these things, and I've learned better how to communicate some of the ideas. And I've also picked up some analogies and illustrations that kind of help get the points across. So I felt like I needed to start there and provide that additional material. As you know, the basic approach that I have to Genesis 1 is to say that in the ancient world, they were much more interested in how the world functioned and how it was ordered. And in fact, its very existence was understood in terms of functioning and being ordered. And therefore, in the ancient world and in the Bible as well, when they talk about creation, they're talking about God bringing order to the world rather than talking about the material processes. God did create the material world as well, but they just weren't as interested in that aspect of it. So they wanted to understand God ordering our world, and particularly ordering it to be a place for us, people in his image, but also ordering it to be a place where he would dwell, sacred space. And so those are the basic elements of my approach to Genesis 1.
Okay. Now, some people might say, but yeah, I mean, you look at the account and it's all about creation over and over. I mean, isn't it just obviously about the material world?
Well, it might seem obvious to us because we automatically believe that it's about the material world. It also sounds automatic to us because we translate in such a way that it makes it sound like it's about the material world. But if you look at each day, you'll find that it gives very little attention to God actually manufacturing material things. The first day, He creates time. The second day, he creates a space for people to live in. The third day, he says, let plants sprout. He's not forming material things. Even when we get to day four and it talks about the sun, moon, and stars, we say, well, they're God's making objects. Well, there's a problem with that. The Israelites didn't know those were objects. They didn't know sun, moon, and stars were material objects. So the Israelites aren't saying, now we're talking about how God made the objects, the material stuff. To them, sun, moon, and stars were lights. And so as we go through the narrative, we find it's not so obvious that it's dealing with material stuff. It's dealing with how things function. When the sun, moon, and stars are discussed, it's about their functions, their signs, seasons, days, and years. And even the verb that we translate to make, which sounds to us very material, is a word that is used for all kinds of activities in the range of causation. So you can make a sacrifice, you can make a garment, you can make a feast, you can make all kinds of things that you're not actually manufacturing them. And so I think we're a little bit led astray by the natural ways that our culture thinks and by the ways we have translated the text in light of those ways of thinking.
Now, that means, and some people would be shocked to hear this better, when you go to the text, it says nothing about the age of the earth.
Well, if Genesis 1 is not talking about God doing the material manufacturing, then what's described in those 7 days is not the material process, and the age of the earth is a material question. If the text isn't dealing with material questions, then the text isn't making a claim. See, that's what I always want to know. I want to know what the authoritative claims of the text are. And so I'm going to work hard to try to understand what that is, but I have to read the text as an ancient text, not as a modern text.
Mm-hmm. So then if we're going to this debate, you could be a younger of creationists or an older of creationists, and still be just fine with your view, right?
Sure. I mean, it doesn't favor one or the other, okay? It just says that's, the text isn't dealing with those issues. But the thing is, you'd have to be making your choice on young Earth or old Earth based on the science, not based on the text, if the text isn't making that kind of claim.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at let's start with about the fifth proposition in your book, then, since I think you've summed up the first four good enough. And that's that when God creates the fun and describes the function of things, he says it's good. What is important about saying it's good, and what is meant by saying it's good?
Lots of people have assumed that when God calls it all good, that he's making a moral statement or a statement about perfection. And when we look at the way that the Hebrew word is used that's in this passage, we find that that's not the nature of it at all. Hebrew has other words for perfection. When God says that it's good, he's indicating that it's functioning the way that he wants it to, that it's now ordered and therefore ready to work. We can see this pretty clearly in a chapter or two along when God says it's not good for man to be alone. That doesn't have to do with moral perfection or design. It just simply has to do with this is not functioning the right way yet. So the word good has to be understood as a Hebrew word, not just an English word that we can make it mean whatever we want.
But someone could say, but look, you've got a universe here and there's death and pain and such in it. How can that be a universe functioning the way it's supposed to be? Doesn't that tell you something's wrong?
Well, it would tell you that something's wrong if you have already decided that you think that God's initial creation was supposed to be perfect. But there's no indication that God intended it to be perfect from the start. In fact, we know that there are some things that are not ordered. There's still the sea, which is part of non-order. Genesis 1:2 tells us that. There's an outside the garden, which is less ordered than inside the garden. People have the job of subduing and ruling, which is bringing more order alongside of God as his vice regents. So when God created, he was not creating full order. He was creating optimal order. And so that's why he calls it good. It's now working the way he intends at this stage of ordering. But there's much more ordering to come.
What would you say to someone who says about this view, says, well, couldn't you just be making a compromise to science here and letting science handle how you're interpreting the text?
Well, that might be a claim somebody could make if they didn't know me and if they didn't talk to me. It's easy for people to assume what someone else's motivations are if they haven't bothered to get to know them or read what they have to say. I'm not making these statements because science is driving it. I was a young earth for a long, long time because I didn't believe that the Bible gave me room to be anything else. Science, I think, is important to prompt us to ask questions that maybe we haven't thought to ask before, but science is not in the driver's seat. This is a conversation that takes place. God created the world, God gave us his word, and we're involved in that conversation. So I'm not making room for a science. Again, I would have done it long ago if that's all that was driving me. But I'm trying to understand the text as an ancient text. When people are trying to make it answer modern questions, they're treating it as a modern text.
Hmm. Well, what if someone says, well, how do we know, though, that ancient people thought this way?
We read their literature. We can tell how people think when they have left us literature by which we can understand them. Over the last 150 years, there are over a million cuneiform tablets that have been dug out of the earth, that have been translated, understood, analyzed, and interpreted. And it's those texts which give us a very good view. It doesn't tell us everything, but it gives us a very good view of how people in the ancient world thought. And so the texts serve as a window to their world. It's not psychoanalysis here. This is not trying to get inside their heads. It's just a matter of reading their literature.
If someone was interested in reading this literature, can you recommend any collection that they could go to, like a place something they could find on Amazon that they could use to read the literature?
The best collection is a three-volume work called Context of Scripture. It's expensive, and it's still extremely limited. One of the problems with getting people involved in understanding the ancient Near East is that it is still so very difficult to get a hold of the texts and to read them. And so that's a problem. So the texts themselves, lots of the most important ones, are available in those three volumes. Of course, we also have works that I've been involved in, like the IVP Bible Background Commentary or the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Background Commentary, where we try to take all of the information from all of the texts and bring out its significance for various passages in Scripture.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we start talking about Adam himself, we can go through the Bible and see the name Adam several times. But according to you, when we see Adam, it doesn't necessarily mean Adam, the man. It can have a number of meanings, right?
Well, sure. The Hebrew word Adam just means humanity. And there are many, many examples where it's clear that that's what it's talking about. Humanity corporately, or even a given individual, but not as a personal name. Even in most of the occurrences in Genesis 2 and 3, the Hebrew text says Ha-Adam, and that Ha means the. And you don't put a the on a personal name in Hebrew. So in most of those occurrences in chapters 2 and 3, it's referring to something broader. It's not using it as a personal name.
So does that mean that if Eve and Adam were in the garden together, she wouldn't call him Adam as a personal name or what?
Well, she wouldn't have called him Adam because Adam is Hebrew and they didn't have Hebrew that early. Likewise, Eve is a Hebrew name. And so by the time we have the biblical account written up, they're using Hebrew names, And no, they weren't speaking Hebrew to one another, whatever they were speaking. Mm-hmm. So that's not what they would call one another.
I did have someone want me to ask you about the Hebrew language that you state, think it was that starts around the second millennium BC. What does that have to say about Mosaic authorship, if anything?
Well, there's a lot of controversy as to when you can actually call a language Hebrew. Because it had precursors. It had other forms of the language that developed into Hebrew. Hebrew is a West Semitic language, mm-hmm. and it developed in relationship to other West Semitic languages, and again, proto-Hebrew kinds of language or texts. So whatever stage of the language Moses was using, it only would have changed gradually. It's not like they woke up one day in the middle of the Judges period and said, I know, let's make a new language. It was all a very slow changing continuity from earlier forms. But in that case, we can kind of track the development of these West Semitic forms and their precursors. Alphabetic script does not show up until the early centuries of the second millennium BC. So people writing before that would not have been writing in alphabetic script. Akkadian and Sumerian are not alphabetic. So again, these things are gradually developing, and there's still a lot about it we don't know.
You know, when we get back to Adam, when we look at the account, is it very proper for us to speak of Adam and Eve in that sense and mean it as personal names in that regard, or should we use something else? And what's your take on this?
Well, eventually in the chapters of Genesis, they do become personal names. Mm-hmm. When chapter 4 talks about Adam having sexual relations with his wife Eve, I mean, they're two people. And so that's how we would treat them. We have to judge by how the text is treating them. Of course, as you know, I do believe Adam and Eve are real people in a real past.
Right.
Whether those were the names they called each other or not, they are real people in a real past.
Mm-hmm. Now, something that I've wondered about the text on reoccurs, when you go through Genesis 3, you hear about the woman over and over, and then at the end it's like, hey, let's name her Eve. Why do you think the name comes at the end of a story instead of at the start of a story?
Adam isn't really named before that either. It's just the man. Mm-hmm. And then when Eve is brought to him, or when she comes to him, he says, oh, this is the same kind of creature that I am. And so you have Ish, a male person, and Isha, a female. Mm-hmm. That's still not names. And so it's really not until we get a little further along in the passage that names are given. We have to remember that names in the ancient world are given to identify someone's role and function or something meaningful about them. And so the idea that Eve should be called Chava, that's the Hebrew form of that, she's the mother of living, that has to do with the role that she's going to be playing.
Now, when we look at the text, a lot of times in some circles, you hear people say, Genesis 1 is giving a general account of a creation. But then when you switch to Genesis 2, it zooms in on this one part of the creation. But you say, no, Genesis 2 comes after Genesis 1 sometime. It's not known how much after, but it does come after.
Yes, okay, there's a couple different questions there. Let me just address them. I see Genesis 1 as talking about how God established sacred space in the cosmos to work on behalf of human beings in his image. I see chapter 2 as how people in God's image are going to function in sacred space. So they both have to do with people in sacred space, Genesis 1, making sacred space for them, Genesis 2, how they work in sacred space. So that gives them a relatedness to one another. Now, in terms of the second question you asked, I think if we address that in terms of, are Adam and Eve the people referred to in chapter one? That's not as straightforward a question as we might think. We generally have assumed that it is, but of course Genesis 1 doesn't mention Adam and Eve, doesn't mention a single pair, just talks about humanity broadly, male and female broadly, and it doesn't really specify whether there's just two and whether it's the ones that we eventually call Adam and Eve. That leaves us several different possibilities to consider, and I think that they're worthwhile considering. The way that I go about talking about it is, okay, when we have the transition between the seven-day account and the Adam and Eve account, we have this phrase in Hebrew in chapter 2, verse 4, and it talks about these are the generations, or this is the account of the heavens and the earth, and it gives us a transition into the second account. I take a look at those transitions as they're used throughout Genesis. There are 10 others of them throughout Genesis, and find that they usually introduce either a sequel, something that comes afterwards, or that it kind of goes back and picks up the same line again, but covering a different story. It never goes back and gives you more information about what it just told you in the previous one. So in other words, most people read Genesis 1 and 2, and they think that Genesis 2 is simply giving us more detail about what happened on day 6. Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't rule that out entirely, but that's not how those transitions usually work in Genesis. And so the idea that the Genesis 2 is talking about a next step, a sequential, something later in time, it might be very close in time, but it's what comes next. And therefore, again, there's not immediate reason to say that Adam and Eve were identified as the people in Genesis 1. Again, they may well have been among them. I think that makes some sense. But again, there could have been many people in Genesis 1. Mm-hmm. Genesis 1 doesn't say.
Well, you know, you've said that the accounts aren't material accounts, but someone can look at Genesis 2 and say, are you really sure about that? I mean, look, Adam is formed from the dust. Eve is made from Adam's rib. That sounds like material creation right there.
Yeah, again, because of the way that we've interpreted those words. Mm-hmm. You look at the Hebrew verb formed, and that sounds very material to us, but when we look at how it's used throughout Hebrew Bible, many times it's not material at all. Zechariah 12:1, for instance, says that he talked about God creating the heavens and the earth, and then it says, and he formed, using the same verb, he formed the human spirit within us. And that's clearly not material. So the verb doesn't have to be material in nature. And when we talk about dust and rib, again, we tend to think of those as material ingredients or something of that sort, but each one of those has some problems associated with it. I don't know if you want me to address that now or not.
Sure, go ahead.
Oh, why not? Go for it. Well, when we read dust, we have to say what's going on here. Some people might think in terms of chemistry, but it wouldn't be very precise chemistry on the one hand, and secondly, Israelites wouldn't be talking about chemistry. This is an ancient text. We have to read it the way it was written. That's where authority is. So they're not thinking chemistry. We might think that they were talking about craftsmanship, but if craftsmanship were the issue, it should be talking about clay, not dust. You can't shape dust. You could shape clay. If craftsmanship were the issue, it should have been using clay. And so the idea of dust now becomes a mystery. Why does the text talk about dust? And we really get our clue in the next passage, in the next chapter, where it talks about the idea that dust you are, and to dust you shall return. And in that way, we find out that dust is the equivalent of mortality. Mm-hmm. And so as we think about that, we understand that the reason it has Adam made from dust is because he's mortal. Now, that gives people a problem, and we'll get to that in a minute. I'm sure you'll press me about that one. But it's what we're doing is we're trying to answer the question, does Genesis 2 try to show us how Adam is different from the rest of us, or is it trying to help us understand how we're all the same? Adam is like all of us. I'm suggesting that Adam formed from dust is not the way that the text is saying. And so he's different from the rest of you who are born through a 9-month process of gestation in the womb. He's not saying that. Instead, we are all formed from dust. Mm-hmm. So we are all like Adam in that way rather than unlike Adam.
Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking at this point, wouldn't there have to be some people that were created through some miraculous act, or it seemed like you'd have an infinite regress of people giving birth? There had to be someone who wasn't, you know, born physically.
Why?
Because you'd keep going backwards. This was born from some woman, this was born from some woman, and you keep going back over and over.
And why is that a problem?
Because then it becomes something like an eternal thing. And we know humanity hasn't been around here forever.
Okay, so you're trying to figure out how the whole process began.
Right.
And again, people who believe in evolution, I don't align myself with that, but people who believe in evolution think they know how that happened. Mm-hmm. And other models might also offer some suggestions. Mm-hmm. But the very idea that we think the Bible is stating, claiming that something was supernatural, meaning that it did not happen in natural ways, natural laws. That's asking the Bible to make a statement that was in a category that they didn't have. In the ancient world, they don't have a category that, like we call natural.
Right.
They believe that God was involved in everything. And so they wouldn't talk about natural laws or natural science or natural cause and effect. And when they say that God does something, they're not making a distinction that he's that it is therefore something that bypasses natural cause and effect. God can do that. Don't get me wrong. God can do that. But the Israelites aren't making that kind of statement because they don't have that kind of category. Therefore, when it tells us that God is involved in doing something, we cannot conclude that there was no natural explanation for it. Because, again, Israelites don't make that statement. That'd be like asking Israelites, well, are you talking about the cellular level or the molecular level? They don't have the categories.
Yeah, I've actually written on my blog that I have so many problems with a so-called natural or supernatural distinction. But what I guess what we could say is if we're wanting to know kind of how it came about and such, that's still asking the wrong kind of question.
Sure. And the fact is there are some places where we have to say, well, the Bible doesn't tell us that. Mm-hmm. And if science does tell us that, we can consider whether science has a good answer or not.
Right.
But if the Bible doesn't tell us, we're kind of on our own to figure out what works.
Okay. So when we go to the Psalms and the Psalm says, he remembers that you are dust. What's he saying about us?
He's saying that we are mortal and frail. Mm-hmm. And the psalmist there, that's one Psalm 103:14, of course. And in that psalm, that's exactly the point. Mm-hmm. And so this mortality and this frailty is something that characterizes human beings, and it has characterized us since our making, because we are all formed from dust.
Well, you know, someone could say, okay, look, I can understand how you couldn't take dust and form it. But a rib, that's something different. A rib's very material. You can picture someone shaping that out some. And, hey, Eve was made from a rib, so there you go.
Yeah, well, good try, of course, except we've got this problem with the Hebrew word tselah that's translated rib. There's no place else in the Old Testament where that is an anatomical term or where it's translated rib. And even the early translators that you find in Septuagint or Vulgate had some uncertainties about that, and the rabbis were discussing it very early on. In the Bible, it's usually an architectural term, and it refers to a side. One side of something, the other side of something. And typically a side when there are two of them. Now, if we're going to take all of that information seriously, and I think we should, as well as information from the use of the similar word in Akkadian, which I think we should, we would say that God took one side of Adam, not a rib. God took one of his sides, and Adam had two of them. Mm-hmm. And God took one of them, and he built Eve from it.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you describe this in the text, though, you say this isn't something that like literally happen. This is a vision that Adam is having, right?
Sure, let's talk about that. Again, the word literal is a little bit tricky, as you know, Nick, because different people mean different things by it. I always, always, always want to read the text for what it is saying, for what the author intended to say, for what he believed his audience would understand. Now, if you think literal is a great word for that, well, fine, you can use it. But that means it also understands that when the text is intending to speak metaphorically or symbolically, that we ought to read it that way. And I don't think there's a lot of people that disagree with that.
Right.
It's just that sometimes people have differences of opinion about whether something should be understood as metaphorically or not. But at any rate, when we first identify this, what God took from Adam as one of his sides, well, that would become fairly radical surgery if you're cutting somebody in half.
Yeah.
And again, Israelites aren't thinking surgery. So what do they mean? What idea do they get when it talks about Adam being in a deep sleep? They're not thinking anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it that they've got in mind? Well, again, to get that, we have to look at how that word is used throughout the Old Testament. And I won't go through all the categories. There are two main categories, but the main one that interests me, that I picked up in my interpretation, is that that's a word that describes somebody who's having a visionary experience. Abraham, for instance, in Genesis 15. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that Adam is in a deep sleep, God's not doing surgery while he's in a deep sleep. God is showing him something that is important sociologically, theologically, spiritually, that this woman, this other living creature, is the same as him. They are of the same sort, the same essence. He's just named the animals, by which he came to the conclusion that none of them are like me. None of them are in my category. Okay, but now, because of what God shows him in this vision, he says, oh yeah, she's bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Notice that, of course, because that means it's not just a rib.
Mm-hmm.
Bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, this is the same as me. Now, again, our philosophical word for that is the same ontology. She's an ontological match. She's of the same essence, which the animals are not.
Mm-hmm. Now, since we have Adam kind of in a vision being cut in half, does that mean we could actually say that Eve was Adam's better half?
I like it. I like it.
Yeah, I've talked about this with some other people as well, that you brought the bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, and she shall be called woman, for she shall be taken from men. And I said, in my past, I've talked to a number of Hebrew scholars about this passage, and I think the best interpretation of what Adam said at point is, wow.
Yeah, obviously it's an exclamation, but it's an exclamation that's not just, woohoo. It's one that identifies precisely what he is gaining from this. So, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, again, this is an ontological identification that's being made here. And that gives him a view, an understanding of what womankind is. And that's pretty important.
So, you said about what he's gaining here. What is Adam gaining from womankind?
He's gaining an ally. Remember, the whole idea was, again, we don't know how to translate that Hebrew word, a helpmate or something of that sort. Mm-hmm. It's a very obscure term, but certainly helper is part of it. And those who are helping others are not viewed as inferior or superior, but as allies.
Mm-hmm.
And so he believes he's being given an ally for the task that he's been given. Again, what task has he been given? He's been given the task of keeping sacred space. That's in 2:15.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about serve and keep, we often think of landscaping. And certainly priests working in the sacred gardens, because they had them all through the ancient Near East, may do some landscaping, but that's not the point. The point is that they are maintaining sacred space and its sacredness. And that's the task that Adam is given. In sacred space, because Eden is sacred space. God dwells there. And so this is giving him an ally in this task of preserving the sacredness of sacred space.
But what's important about this ally also being different from, because it is man and woman, not just two guys managing the garden. Is there something special about it being a woman?
Sure. It's again, he sees this as the other half of himself.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? He wouldn't view another man in that way. He views a woman that way,
mm-hmm.
that she is the other half of himself. Mm-hmm. And so, again, they're an ontological match. Mm-hmm. Now, two men or two women are in the same ontological category, but here they're seeing something closer. Remember, the text goes on to differentiate why a man would leave his mother and father. His mother and father are in the same ontological category that he is, but yet he leaves them in order to be united to his wife, mm-hmm. who he sees as his ontological match.
Mm-hmm.
And that's stronger than a biological relationship.
Mm-hmm. What does that tell us about marriage today? Can we get anything out of the text about marriage for us?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's establishing marriage as a sociological institution, but it is telling us the nature of the relationship between man and woman.
Mm-hmm.
This is a relationship that recognizes that they belong together, that they're halves of a whole. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that every couple that gets married are individually half of the other one.
Mm-hmm.
This is talking about the species. This is talking about genders and womankind and mankind in general. That's the nature of them. So it tells us about that relationship between man and woman, but it's basically in the category of ontology, which should tell us, by the way, that ontologically men and women are equal.
Mm-hmm. Now, well, we can look for it and says it's not good for man to be alone, and I do still have several single friends who would say, amen, amen, preach it, brother, at that point, but that's also... You're talking about humanity as a whole. It's not saying every single person has to get married.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And again, but this isn't really talking about companionship. I think it has implications for companionship, but it's really talking about the task that together they will carry out.
Now, also, you're talking about speaking about it, so shows how we relate to each other. Some women could get upset and says, well, look, Eve is described as a helper. Isn't that a lesser term? Doesn't that put the woman in a lower place?
Well, no, it certainly doesn't, because the person that's most often a helper in the Old Testament is God, mm-hmm. and being a helper doesn't put him in a lower place. Mm-hmm. That's why I mentioned that it really talks about allies.
Mm-hmm.
That's the key to the term, as best we can understand it. It's mm-hmm. an alliance, not indicating one as inferior and another as superior.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you... go and look at them. You talk about these people, Adam and Eve, being archetypes. What do we mean by that term? That might not be a term that many people are immediately familiar with.
Yeah, let me draw two distinctions that might help. Some people might be aware of a literary archetype. So you've got the classic villain, you've got the classic miser, you know, Scrooge.
Yeah.
You've got the classic hero, humble hero, Bilbo. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got these literary archetypes where you build a certain characteristic into them, that a good story will have lots of these literary archetypes. That's not what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Some people might also get the word confused with a similar term, prototype. In fact, some dictionaries will, when you look up one, they'll say, see the other. And that's not helpful. Prototype is the first one in a sequence. But an archetype, the way I'm talking about it, is one that embodies everything else in the class. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, in that sense, I don't know what that was.
Mm-hmm.
In that sense, the idea that the archetype that represents all of those others that are in that category is an important understanding of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when I heard that sound just now, I was thinking, wouldn't it be amusing if that was the doorbell and Jehovah's Witnesses were coming right now?
Yeah. Now, no, I see what it was. Okay, never mind. Go ahead.
Now, when we talk about archetypes, though, we can move forward a little bit and say there is one famous archetype talked about a lot in the Bible, and that's Jesus.
Sure. And because, again, Jesus represents all of us in certain ways.
Mm-hmm.
But likewise, Adam does. And most mm-hmm. every time that the New Testament talks about Adam and Eve, they talk about them as archetypes that have an element of representation in mm-hmm. them.
So when we look at Romans 5, we have Adam seen as representing all of us, and he falls. Jesus representing all of us, and he succeeds.
Right.
And then when Paul speaks about the first Adam, he's not necessarily meaning the first man chronologically. He could be meaning that, but it doesn't necessitate that. It could just refer to the first archetype. And then Jesus being the last Adam, we know he couldn't definitely be the last chronological man, because looking at the calendar, I think you and I at least were both born after Jesus was. So he's saying Jesus would be the last archetype then, right?
Well, he compares Adam and Jesus as archetypes, and they're both then significant in the roles that they play and the ways that they represent all of us. Mm-hmm. I view Adam as the fountainhead of humanity, but he plays that role not because he necessarily, I don't know, but necessarily was the biological first.
Mm-hmm.
He played that role because he was chosen, elect, to be a priestly representative in sacred space.
Mm-hmm.
And that establishes him as the fountainhead of humanity and serving as this representative archetype for us.
Now that's going to surprise a lot of people and get them maybe a bit cautious at this point, to say, don't we know Adam and Eve were the first persons, and why are we going around saying there were other people at the same time?
Well, we only would know they were the first people if the text made that clear to us. And in some interpretations of the text, people have felt like it does make that clear, but I suggest otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Besides dealing with the texts themselves with Adam and Eve, I think it's also worthwhile noting that in chapter 4, we have several instances where it seems like there are other people around. Cain finds a wife. Cain builds a city. Cain's afraid that other people will kill him. And, you know, it's not like nobody's ever had answers for those. They talk about Cain marrying his sister.
Mm-hmm.
Not a great option. They talk about the fact that maybe Abel has had many children who have grown up and had children by this time before he gets killed, and those will seek Cain's life in revenge. I mean, there are ways that you can kind of fiddle with it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, is that really satisfactory?
So we've got a new answer now to the old question of where did Cain get his wife that was supposed to kill biblical Christianity for several years, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So these people that were living, were they living in sin? Were they living as holy, righteous people, or what?
Yeah. I believe that the fall comes about through Adam and Eve and their choices.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if people already believe that there may have been other people besides Adam and Eve, preceding Adam and Eve, alongside of Adam and Eve, then of course the question of, well, what about sin? Are these people living holy lives? Certainly anthropological evidence doesn't suggest that. How does this all work? And I think that Paul gives us the direction for a solution right after he talks about the fact that we are all subject to death because of sin.
Mm-hmm.
He also talks about the idea that without the law, there is no sin. Now, he doesn't mean that without the law, there is no behavior that we would assess as sinful in nature.
Mm-hmm.
He rather is making the case of accountability. That is, without some kind of law, there is no accountability. And so that's why we would differentiate between a state of perfection or a state of innocence. And I would say for people who believe that there might have been other humans around besides Adam and Eve before the fall, that they all would have been in a state of innocence. It's not that they weren't doing anything that you could biblically call sinful. It's rather that they're not being held accountable for it because they have not yet been given that basis for accountability. After all, we don't say that a horse sins. It's not accountable in a moral state. We would not say dogs sin, except some of us have dogs that we really wonder.
Yeah. When we hear that, Part of me just seems a bit confused because it sounds like, I mean, the law comes through Moses, according to Paul. So does that mean that everyone before Moses was living in a state of innocence, but then that leaves a trouble of why was Egypt judged and why were Sodom and Gomorrah judged?
Well, they may have been living in a state of innocence with regard to the law, okay, but you always have to ask the case, has anything been given as a basis for accountability?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the law was given at the time of Moses, and you could talk about that as a dividing line of sorts, but for Adam and Eve, we have the tree and the prohibition connected to the tree. That's where a law was given. So you have to judge it by the context. God typically does not hold people like the Philistines or the Moabites or whatever it might be accountable to the law because they didn't receive the law. But nevertheless, he holds them accountable for other basic behaviors that they were responsible to carry out.
And one example I use with that is in Leviticus 18 and 20, when the Israelites are being set to prepare to conquer the land, and they're told about the practices they shouldn't engage in, and it's usually a long list of sexual practices there, and the text says, "For the same reason I am driving out these nations before you," which means the other nations essentially should have known better.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
There is a basic level of accountability that they should have had.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about these people being the archetypes, what difference does that make for us?
Well, that means again that in the in what I call the forming accounts, that's mm-hmm. dust and rib.
Mm-hmm.
In the forming accounts, if they're serving as archetypes, then the text is trying to make a statement about all of us, mm-hmm. not just make a statement about Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
So that would mean all human beings are formed from dust. And again, we have a place like Psalm 103:14 to say that, as well as places in Paul.
Mm-hmm.
All human beings are made from dust. It's not saying what Adam uniquely is. All womankind is from the side of mankind. It's not talking about what Eve uniquely is. So once we identify the language as archetypal, and again, we do that by asking the question, is this something true of all of us or not? And if it is true of all of us, then it's not making a unique statement about Adam and Eve, and therefore it's not trying to give them a different sort of material biological origins.
I think at this point we also need to step into another book that you contributed to, and that was Four Views on the Historical Adam, where you did make the argument that Adam and Eve are archetypal persons, but they are still real historical persons. Why do you think that, and what difference does it make?
Well, I think that because I think that's what the Bible affirms. Again, I'm always after what is it that the Bible is claiming.
Mm-hmm.
And as I read how they're treated not only in Genesis but also in the New Testament, I'm convinced that the text is treating them as real people in a real past.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not convinced that it treats them as the first and only at the time when they were created,
mm-hmm.
but I do believe it treats them as real people in a real past.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, that's where I go.
Okay. Now, there was at the end of the book, I mean, you had two people, one Greg Boyd, who said, you know, I think these are real people, but it's not really that big an issue. And then someone else, he said, well, if Adam and Eve aren't real, then, you know, there's no original sin, there's no basis for judgment, then there's no need for redemption, and lo and behold, there's no need for Christianity. So if Adam and Eve aren't real, well, the whole thing goes down. What do you think?
I think it's a position that is easy to overstate, although in general, I agree that the need for a point of sin is important.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the reasons why I still accept the historical Adam. I don't know how else to understand sin except in that way. Now, I want to be careful because there's other people who feel like they can work that one okay, and that they don't have a problem with all of that, but I'm not there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that connection between historical Adam and the historical fall and original sin, I think that's an important connection.
You know, I agree with you on this. I mean, I hold to the historical Adam also, but that kind of objection, it's never really carried much weight to me, because I look and I still say, you know, I'm sorry, but I'm looking and it still seems pretty obvious to me that we are sin, and that there's still something to be taken care of, even if we don't know how it all got started.
And again, that's an easy thing to affirm. Theologians have never been content with just saying, yes, so somehow it happened. they want to figure that out.
Yeah, but I mean, this is an important issue, but at the same time, we're not going to say it's a salvation issue or anything.
Well, I don't think that what we believe about historical Adam is a salvation issue. Mm-hmm. You still would have to figure out, so how do you think this sin thing works? Mm-hmm. And some of the alternatives, we would say, well, maybe. Other alternatives, you would say, boy, that doesn't seem to cut it. You know, different people have different understanding of this, but all of that is a matter of interpretation. Mm-hmm. I don't see those people coming along and saying, oh, there's no such thing as sin. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a different category of argument altogether.
Yeah. Now, when you wrote the Lost World Genesis 1, you describe the creation being prepared as sacred space. Now, in this book, you describe Garden of Eden being prepared as sacred space. How does that work? I mean, if a whole world is sacred space, wouldn't the garden be sacred space as well automatically?
Well, God in chapter 1, when I wrote Lost World of Genesis 1, I was using the concept of the cosmos as a temple. Mm-hmm. As I got more and more involved in conversations on that, I realized that could be a little bit misleading, because usually a temple delineates and demarcates where sacred space is, you know, locationally. Mm-hmm. And that means that with a temple, you've got an inside and an outside. Mm-hmm. That means you can't really think of the whole cosmos as a temple, because then it's all inside and none outside. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's when I started being more intentional about saying the cosmos is being set up as sacred space, mm-hmm, in Genesis 1. At that point, the whole cosmos is being prepared to become sacred space, but it has not yet told you where the center of that sacred space is, because the center of sacred space is where God's presence is. Mm-hmm. It's only in chapter 2 that we find out that we've got a terrestrial center of sacred space, Eden, where God's presence is located, and that still makes the whole cosmos sacred space, although the basic premise is that the center of sacred space is the most sacred, and there is diminishing sacredness the further you move out. So that's why there's an outside the garden, which is less sacred and less ordered than inside the garden.
Could this relate to when we look at the Old Testament temple, we see the Holy of Holies, and then outside that there's a holy place, and then outside that there's a place where, yeah, this is still holy, but, you know, you can have other people walk around it and things like that.
Sure, same thing. That's those concentric circles. Mm-hmm. And there were higher demands for the antechamber than there were for the courtyard. But the, mm-hmm, courtyard was still sacred space. Mm-hmm. It's just further out. Mm-hmm. The camp had certain requirements, because you could get kicked outside the camp. Mm-hmm. And so there's this diminishing sacredness as you move through the zones. But you only know how that works once you have the center located.
Yes.
And Genesis 1 didn't locate the center.
Yeah, I'm thinking right now how in Deuteronomy, for instance, it says that when you go out, make sure to take a shovel with you so that when you get done with your excrement, you can dig a hole and cover it up so that the ground won't be defiled when God walks among you. And think, yeah, God's not going to let you go into the most holy place and use the bathroom right there.
That's right. They don't have restrooms there. The government had not gotten involved yet in kind of requirements.
How does this relate then to Revelation 21 and 22, where you have, is there an inside or an outside? When we get to the end of a story, is everything then the perfect or the wonderful sacred space it was meant to be?
Sure, and that's where new creation is going. Mm-hmm. I am not of the opinion that new creation goes back and recreates Eden. Mm-hmm. Eden, the pre-fall scenario, was not fully ordered. Mm-hmm. There was non-order, and then with sin came disorder. Mm-hmm. Revelation 21 talks about the fact that there will be no sin, there will be no suffering, there will be no pain, there will be no tears, but also there will be no sea, mm-hmm. which is non-order. There will be no darkness, which mm-hmm. is non-order. Okay, and because so both non-order and disorder are being resolved, which they weren't in the pre-fall situation.
Mm-hmm.
And then the temple, it says there will be no temple.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's because there is no no demarcation to be made. It's all of the same level of sacredness because God will be in dwelling among his people.
Well, I'd like to remind everyone right now that you're listening to the Deeper Waters podcast. I am Nick Peters, your host. Right now we've got John Wharton from Wheaton, author of a new book coming out soon, The Lost World of Adam and Eve, which I'm able to talk about since I've got an advanced copy here, which is really awesome to get. But if you're listening next week, we're going to have Jerry Walls from Houston Baptist University on. He's going to be talking about his book, Heaven, Hell, and Purgatory. It's going to be an interesting conversation, Ben, as we discuss these three different topics together. So if you're a fan of Jerry Walls, you're going to want to be here next week to hear that. But for now, we've still got John Wharton here. We're talking about his book, The Lost World of Adam and Eve. Now, when we're talking about Eden, and Eden isn't this perfect paradise, and God's not saying at the end, okay, we're just going to go back to Eden. But Eden, the state that things were, it was still better off than what we've got right now, wasn't it?
Oh, sure. And again, I make a distinction. There's Eden and the garden.
Mm-hmm.
The garden is associated with Eden, but it's not Eden because it tells us that water flowed from Eden and watered the garden.
Mm-hmm.
That suggests that the garden is adjoining Eden, not Eden itself.
Mm-hmm.
Eden is where God lives. That's the source of the waters. The garden is adjoining it where people would meet with God.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is sin has not occurred. It is ordered optimally for how God wanted it to be. God is dwelling among his people, which is how he always wanted it. And so that's all set up. But still, there's a lot of order to bring because they're asked to subdue and rule.
When you talk about the waters flowing, would that relate to the imagery we see in Ezekiel 47 and in Revelation 21 with the water flowing from the temple and the throne of God?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's both of those places, and you can find it all throughout the ancient Near East.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of waters flowing from the place where God's dwelling was is a standard motif, iconography, texts, everywhere.
That's probably why the Egyptians viewed the Nile as a sacred river, isn't it?
Sure.
Now, what does this say about our quest we often have with trying to find where the Garden of Eden was located? Because there are two specific rivers mentioned that we do know about, but the other two we're not so sure about.
Right, and so there's a lot of discussion about it. Some have made them some other rivers like the Nile. Some have made them, for instance, one of them is called Gihon, and they connect it to the Gihon Spring in Jerusalem. Another recent suggestion puts them up in the region of the Ararat Mountains and two major rivers up there, the Halys, and I forget what the other one is. And so there are various suggestions for trying to identify them.
Mm-hmm.
But so far that's not proven something that we can be certain of.
I know Hugh Ross has said that he thinks they could have been in a place where the Persian Gulf is right now.
Well, I suppose, although if they're flowing out of it, the rivers flow into the Persian Gulf, not out of it.
What would this say though about so many people who think our origins come from Africa instead of a more Middle Eastern area?
Well, that comes from the anthropological evidence, and when you start trying to mesh together the anthropological or the genetic, for that matter, or the fossil, when you start trying to mesh those things together, you end up trying to draw biblical conclusions from anthropology, which it doesn't do, or anthropological conclusions from the Bible, which it doesn't do. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not trying to say these are non-overlapping magisteria. I'm not right. Stephen Jay Gould. The fact is that if one doesn't address the other, mm-hmm. it's very difficult to do a competent job of pushing them together. We may mm-hmm. well believe that they could be integrated given enough information. That doesn't mean we can do it.
So it could be that at one point in time, humans or their predecessors originate in Africa and eventually move to the Middle East area, so, and that's where the Adam and Eve story takes place.
There are all kinds of people that engage in the anthropological data that mm-hmm. come up with various theories. I'm not an anthropologist, okay. so I don't deal with that.
Now, when we talk about the garden, it's described as sacred space. And man is given a task in the garden, isn't he?
Yes, yes. We find that in Genesis 2:15. Mm-hmm. It's usually translated to work and to keep. Mm-hmm. We find that those are both priestly terms. Mm-hmm. It's true that you can work the ground. That was even earlier in Genesis 2. When ground is the direct object of that verb, then it talks about farming kinds of activities. Mm-hmm. But we also find that that's the typical verb used to describe priestly activities. Mm-hmm. And so here, it's working in the garden. If you think of the garden as a place where you're growing food, you might think in those terms. But if you think of the garden as a place that's sacred space, you've got a different aspect. And the fact that the second verb is not used for landscaping or agrarian activities suggests that we are dealing with sacred space. Priests also guard, they keep, they preserve sacred space. That's the main task of priests.
Mm-hmm. Now, what also do you think about the passage in Genesis 2, I think even before the creation of man, where it talks about a mist coming up from the ground and watering the ground because it had not rained? What's going on with that passage?
Yeah, we wish we knew. You know, some of the words there are fairly obscure. What is clear is that it's describing a not yet scenario, which is very common in ancient Near Eastern texts. Mm-hmm. Here's the things that weren't working yet. Here's the things that weren't there yet. Almost every cosmology text in the ancient Near East starts with that kind of scenario. It's the same as Genesis 1:2. So it was tohu vavohu, formless and void. So the description of the negative, what wasn't there, is set up for then providing those sorts of things.
Well, what about some people who would say, so when we get to the story of Noah, that's the first time we have any rain, and that's why it was such a surprise to the people.
Well, you can't really draw that from the biblical text. This is saying there was no rain before Genesis 2. Genesis 2, is way long before Noah. Uh-huh. So there's no suggestion here that there was no rain even up until the time of Noah.
Now, when we talk about Adam being a priest, would that also incur the greater possibility of there being other people around, because a priest has to represent other people?
That's certainly one of the conclusions you could draw. Priests are typically representing others. Priests are in sacred space, representing others who are not in sacred space. Mm-hmm. So that would be one of the options that would present. You could make the case differently and say, well, they're serving as a priest for all the people who come after. Mm-hmm. Those are the kinds of arguments that flow back and forth.
Now, when we see that Eve is in the garden, also, she's got an important task to play to help Adam, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it would extend beyond just Eve is there only to meet his sexual needs, most likely. She's got deeper roles than that, right?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, chapter 2 is not talking about propagation of the race or reproduction. Mm-hmm. That was mentioned in chapter 1, of course, be fruitful and multiply. Mm-hmm. But that's not the context in which God says it's not good for man to be alone because mm-hmm. he can't propagate the race by himself or because he's missing out on sexual pleasure. I mean, that's really not the drift there at all.
Yeah.
The idea of her being an ally of his. An ally in what? Mm-hmm. Well, it's just mentioned the idea of what Adam's task is, of serving in sacred space. Mm-hmm. And she's his ally. That means she also is serving alongside of him in sacred space, doing the same work of the priestly roles.
Mm-hmm. Would that be a surprise? Because the priestly roles were normally held by men in the Old Testament. Would this be the only case of a woman holding such a role?
Certainly Levitical priesthood, Aaron priesthood, those were limited to the men. Mm-hmm. But remember that we have a larger priesthood that's mentioned in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. That is that Israel was chosen as a royal priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
That is, they are priests to the nations. And that would have included men and women in Israel. So mm-hmm. when we think about Adam and Eve as priests, we should be thinking more in terms of how we find Israel designated among the nations than we should think about the ones carrying out the ritual practices that were known in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of priesthood that we would be talking about.
Okay, so this wasn't a priesthood like making sacrifices for the sins of a people or things like that, right?
Priests are responsible for maintaining sacred space.
Mm-hmm.
When you've got people who have the potential for sinning, of course, as the Israelites did, and we all do, then part of maintaining sacred space was to be the mediator for these rituals that had to take place, because the rituals, the sacrifices, could serve as gifts to God, but they could also serve to be cleansing sacred space, to be taking care of sin. And therefore, the priests are involved in that. But that's only because they have the larger task of preserving sacred space.
Mm-hmm.
The most important thing that they had going was that God was dwelling in their midst.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want to do anything to lose that. And therefore, you do whatever it takes to keep the sacred space clean. And that's what the priest's role was.
What would this have to do with when we get to a book like 1 Peter, where we're compared to a new temple and we're told we're a kingdom of priests and we have a priesthood of all believers? How does that relate to us, then?
Well, it's relating exactly the same way. If we are the temple, as Paul says we are, then we, the church, corporately and individually, are sacred space, and we have a duty to preserve sacred space, to preserve God's presence for what it ought to be. And
mm-hmm.
so we are a kingdom of priests because we mediate God's revelation of himself
mm-hmm.
to the world around us. We mediate access to God because as we tell people how they can gain access to God through Christ, we're making that possible for them.
Mm-hmm.
So we are mediators of revelation and access to sacred space, and Adam and Eve and other priests would have been the same thing. Israel is the same thing for the nations.
And we're supposed to be holy representatives in that regard, as our priests are, and we also have God dwelling in us as the Holy Spirit this time.
Absolutely.
Now, I remember someone describing the Garden of Eden once this way, and I'd kind of like to see what you think about it. He said, imagine going to a job site like Career Builder or Monster and seeing this, this description of a job. Yeah, I've got a little garden somewhere and I'd like you to come in and take care of it, and you're going to be working the whole time there, but you can bring your wife and you can make out with her as much as you want as long as you just tend the garden. I'll take care of all your food needs. I'll take care of all your health needs. You'll have everything provided for you. The only rule you can get is that where there's one tree in the garden, I don't really want you eating the fruit of that tree, but everything else, you can eat what you want, you can do what you want, just make sure the garden's taken care of. I mean, to me that sounds like a pretty good job that you could get.
Yeah, but I think it misses entirely the point of the passage.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea is that God has decided, okay, we haven't have to start before that. God created people
right,
because he wanted to be in relationship with them.
Mm-hmm.
And he intended to be in relationship with them by dwelling among them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the cosmos was made sacred space, and Eden became a sacred space as God took up his dwelling place among his people. The
mm-hmm.
most important thing about the garden is not its food or its lovely park-like appearance or its wonderful place to be, or that man and woman are there kind of having a great time. The most important part of the garden is that this is the chance for God to be with his people and for people to be in relationship with him. That's what it's all about.
Yep.
So, go ahead.
No, you finish first.
Well, the idea of the garden as anything else that's not directed towards sacred space is kind of taking our attention away from what it's set up to be in Genesis.
Yeah, first thing I'm thinking is I'm being reminded that in other ancient Near Eastern accounts, humans were kind of created as an afterthought or an accident, and their main purpose was fodder for the gods. I mean, they brought food to the gods and things like that, but in Genesis it's completely different.
Right. I would say certainly afterthought, but not accident. The gods did it intentionally because they wanted slave labor. The gods in the ancient Near East had needs. They were sick and tired of meeting their own needs because it was hard work. So they created slave labor. And the job of people, the main job of people, was to the care and feeding of the gods, to take care of the gods. And in exchange, the gods would take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I call it the great symbiosis of the ancient world.
Mm-hmm.
Gods taking care of people, people taking care of gods, a codependence based on mutual needs. That's what it was in the ancient world. Of course, the Bible is making a very different point. God doesn't have any needs. And the garden adjoining sacred space is not to give him food, like it was in the rest of the ancient Near East. This is rather God one way that God provides food for his people. And so it's a very different view of what people are, the role they play, and how they fit into the whole system.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about the description of the garden I gave and that misses a point, I can't help but think, we seem to do the exact same thing today, that when we think about heaven, we think about, you know, seeing our loved ones again, living forever, no pain, no sorrow, no death. Those are all great things. Those are wonderful things. But if we lose sight of the main thing, that we're in the presence of God forever, we're really missing the point of it.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of heaven and eternity is not about us. It's about God.
Yeah, it's in fact been my view of heaven and hell that they're really not so much places as they're defined by relationships, and that if you love God, then being in his presence forever, well, it's heaven. And if you've rejected God and you don't want anything to do with the things of God, and you're in his presence forever, well, it's hell.
Well, you'll have to have a podcast with yourself on that one, Nick.
Yeah, that's fine. I might do that later on in the future, but let's get to the garden a little bit more also. One aspect I'm thinking about with the garden is, are you familiar with C.S. Lewis's book, Paralandra?
Sure, love it.
Yeah, because that's the kind of thing I was thinking of, because you've said, I mean, there quite likely were real trees in the garden, and a tree of knowledge, and a tree of life, but the trees are pretty much also not the main thing. It could have been anything else, couldn't it?
Well, I wouldn't say that in the same way that Lewis says it in Paralandra. Sleeping on the dry land, right? Or the island or something.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, but there it's kind of arbitrary. And it's only based on the idea of having a prohibition that you can choose to obey or disobey.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's nothing inherent in the thing itself. I think in the Old Testament account in Genesis 3, well, 2 and 3, this represents wisdom. It doesn't just represent obedience. It represents wisdom. And wisdom is connected to order. Order flows from God's presence. Wisdom flows from God. They have their source in him. And so this is a real issue connected to this. This is not just a matter for obeying or disobeying. It's a matter for having wisdom or not. Now, we would say, why would God tell them they can't have wisdom? Usually wisdom's a pretty good thing. And we would think that God would want them to have it.
Mm-hmm.
He does. But wisdom is not something you can grasp on your own in your own time. Wisdom is a process that requires mentorship and training and experience and all kinds of things. Usually you learn wisdom from a wise person.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, it's not something that they can grasp on their own.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what they do. So I think it goes beyond Lewis's concept in Paralandra, because I think there is something real here, not just a prohibition to be obeyed or disobeyed.
Yeah, this is something that really speaks to our instant society today, because when you think about discipleship, we want to have everything to us immediately. I mean, I'm doing this show for you on the internet here, and that's our mindset. Why should I have to go to the library, for instance, and read a book? I'll just type it out on the internet, and I will get my answer right there.
Sure, we always want it faster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we try to figure out how we can do something in one click instead of two.
Mm-hmm.
We want it fast.
Mm-hmm.
And that's never how wisdom is. Wisdom comes through a long process.
Mm-hmm.
So they were forbidden to eat of the tree, not because wisdom was bad, but because
right.
There's supposed to be a process.
I'd like to remind everyone that you are listening to the Deeper Waters podcast at this point. And everything we do here is listener-supported. It's supported by people like you. And I hope you will support us. And also go to our iTunes page and leave a good review there. It really cheers me up when I see a very good review here. But if you want to support us, we've got a new website now that we've got the blog and the podcast all connected with. And that's deeperwaters.ddns.net. You go there, you can find everything. In fact, you can find, just put up this week, I was on a show last Wednesday called Atheist Analysis, being interviewed for 2 hours by an atheist. So yes, I know what it's like to sit in the hot seat for 2 hours here and being asked questions about the historical Jesus. So if you want to hear that, you can go there, and we've got other events I've been involved in, such as my debate I had last year with Ken Humphreys on whether or not Jesus lived, which seems to be a recurring theme in my discussions nowadays. But there is a donate button there. If you click that, you'll go to the Ministry of Risen Jesus, which is the ministry of my father-in-law and his wife, Mike and Debbie Lacona. Have you gone to the right place? Yes, you have. You make your donation there, and then you email me or you email Debbie and say, hey, I made a donation. I want to go to Nick Peters and Deeper Waters. We will make sure that it does go to us, and it will be tax-deductible entirely. Then you can go to the Amazon store. We've got several books there. I still need to update that, and yes, I will be adding John Walton's book when I do there, so that when you buy a book through the Amazon store there, some of the proceeds will go to us. So, hey, if you're going to buy the book, why not do it that way anyway? And then if you're willing to buy other books, I've got some e-books there for sale. One of the latest ones I'm specifically proud of is my book on the Apostles' Creed, A Creed for the Ages. And here's where I've got the e-book I co-wrote with my ministry partner, J.P. Holding, called Defining Inerrancy, which is a look at the inerrancy debates today, and a more rich view, I think, of inerrancy that can be more easily defend, but we really need your support, so please, please consider it. I mean, we've got our little garden right here now where we're producing the fruit of good apologetic information for you and good scholarship. Take part in the harvest with us, because it's a lot of work and we could use your support. Now, Dr. Walton, do you have any organization you'd like to encourage people to donate to?
Yes. I mean, alongside of your fine apologetics organization, another apologetics organization that involves more having dialogue with people online, just all the time, engaging people through chat rooms, through emails, through Facebook. It's an organization called The Third Choice.
Mm-hmm.
And don't spell out third. That's 3RD.
Mm-hmm.
TheThirdChoice.org. And they're engaging these same kinds of conversations in a little different medium than what you do, Nick.
Mm-hmm.
But my brother's running that ministry. He's a youth pastor for 30 years and really works hard at engaging, especially people who are leaving the faith or considering coming to the faith and need some answers.
Mm-hmm.
So I would urge people to take a look at that also. You can donate online. It's the3rdchoice.org.
You know, that is such an important group to reach, because so many of our young people are falling away. And it's also really important that we discuss questions like this, because Genesis 1 to 11 is usually a strong reason for their falling away.
Yeah, and also on that website, you can get my whole 2-hour-plus DVD presentation that you can view and download for free.
Nice. Okay, that's enough incentive for me right there. Now, when we're talking about this, sometimes when I meet skeptics of the faith, they hear talk about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. I say, well, see, Adam and Eve didn't even know what good and evil were. How could they be judged? Are they really misreading the text?
Yeah, when you look around at how the phrase knowledge of good and evil is used throughout the Old Testament, you find that it does pertain to wisdom. And you get that even in Genesis 2, where Eve looks at the fruit and says, it is good to make one wise. Mm-hmm. So that we know that this has to do with wisdom, not just any little thing that could be considered good or bad to do. Mm-hmm. And so this is a wisdom tree. We've got a life tree and we've got a wisdom tree.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've also said before that I think it's kind of a mirrorism going on, where you give two opposites as if to say everything in between them is included. So it was kind of a way of trying to say they wanted to know everything that they could immediately.
Well, certainly it has a meristic element to it, but if it has to do with wisdom, it's not all knowledge, it's not omniscience. It's rather that they want to know how things work. They want, more importantly, remember, they want to be like God, which means that they want to order it themselves, and they want to order it around themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's the nature of the fall.
Now, this temptation came from the creature called the serpent. What do we know about the serpent from this text alone?
Well, not a whole lot. I mean, he's identified as one of the creatures of the field, and it uses the word nachash, which can be just any old kind of serpent in terms of biblical Hebrew terminology. Yet he's described as arum. That's the that's sometimes translated clever or crafty or shrewd. There's a whole lot more to it than that. And it's a term that kind of gives us some understanding of its nature. What's important to say, and you're probably getting at this, is that in the Old Testament, they have no recognition of this as Satan.
Right.
So that's not on their minds. It's not in any kind of profile that they've got. And that would not be how they thought about this creature.
Now, when we get to Revelation 12, and we hear that John's referring to the dragon as the serpent, that is going back to Genesis 3, isn't it?
Sure, and there they're drawing a connection between them. They're associating this dragon, and by the way, of course, there it seems in Revelation they do have a dragon in mind, not just a snake. And that brings about the idea of a chaos creature.
Right.
In the ancient world, they believed in chaos creatures. We can see a list of them in Isaiah 27:1, with Leviathan and things like that, and Nachash is among them. And so in that sense, we can see that the Old Testament audience would have been more likely to think of the serpent as a chaos creature. A chaos creature is not intrinsically evil. A chaos creature is simply a wild card, non-order, can bring about disorder. But that's how they would have viewed chaos creatures in the ancient world.
But if a serpent was an evil creature, since we know from New Testament it was the devil, what would an evil creature be doing in sacred space?
Well, we're not even told that the serpent is in sacred space. We sometimes make an assumption that Adam and Eve are in the garden all the time and never go out, but that's an assumption. We make an assumption that the conversation is taking place right by the tree. That's not in the text. That's an assumption. So the whole idea of where Adam and Eve encountered the serpent all of that, we just don't have a lot of information about it.
So when we're asked about what this creature is, like, is it a talking snake? Is it an angel? We don't really know, right?
Correct. You know, again, if if the indications we get in the biblical text are correct, it's a chaos creature, and chaos creatures are in a slightly different category. Now, it does say, of all the creatures that God had created. So this is a created creature, but that's what they believed about chaos creatures. Mm-hmm. In Genesis 1, the great sea creatures in 1:21, those are chaos creatures. And yet it specifically says that these are created by God.
So what does this say about the nature of the curse, for instance, with how the serpent will eat dust and crawl on the ground, that the woman will have pain in childbirth and desire to rule her husband, the man will have to toil the ground to get his food?
We very frequently refer to that as the curse, and I think that's a little bit of a misidentification. The serpent is cursed and the ground is cursed. People are not. And even there, the word that they translate cursed for the ground and for the serpent doesn't have to do with a hex or a spell or something like that. It has to do with kind of distance. Mm-hmm. So the serpent is distanced from other creatures of the field. The ground and humanity have this distance between them, in a sense, that means there's no cooperation going on here. The people have to work hard for it. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of word. But people are not cursed in Genesis 3. Cain is in Genesis 4. That's the same word for curse. Mm-hmm. But Adam and Eve are not. Mm-hmm. And so I would consider the statements God makes to Adam and Eve more like a parental conversation where he's talking to them about the consequences of their behavior. The fact that death is now going to be prominent in the system and that therefore there's going to be some repercussions. So consequences rather than punishment. The punishment was you will die or be doomed to death. That's the punishment. Mm-hmm. Chapter 3 is not more punishment. I'm going to get worse. Not only are you doomed to death, but, you know, so it's dealing with the consequences. So, you know, a woman is going to be anxious. You know, we talk about pain in childbearing, and the Hebrew word here has more to do with anxiety. And it talks about her anxiety starting in conception. Of course, conception is not painful, but there's anxiety connected to it, especially in an ancient society where if you didn't conceive a child, you could be dismissed as a wife. Mm-hmm. There's great anxiety about conception. Mm-hmm. Also, of course, with very high mother mortality in giving birth, not only child mortality, but mother mortality. The minute you hear that you're pregnant, you for what, 1 out of 5, 1 out of 7, I don't know what the numbers were, that means that you've got 9 months to live. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of anxiety connected with it. All that anxiety is because of death. And so God's really saying that, yes, you still are going to be fruitful and multiply, but be aware, the consequences now, you've got an anxiety-fraught process here in bringing forth children. And likewise, Adam, an anxiety-fraught process in trying to get enough food to survive. These things talk about survival, which is now an important discussion, with death being more on the table.
Yeah, this is also going to get us into something interesting. You were saying that I'd probably get you on a bit later on asking you some questions, and yeah, I think it's time to ask that. But actually, it's a view I agree with, because I came to this view about a decade or so ago, just thinking about it, and that's the view that Adam and Eve were not created immortal.
And I don't know that there's anything biblically that would suggest they are. We usually think that Paul's saying that they were created immortal because he says that we are subject to death because of sin. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not the same thing as saying that they were created immortal. Mm-hmm. The idea that if they were created immortal, I'll get to that in a minute, if they were created mortal, then God provided an antidote, a remedy in the tree of life. Mm-hmm. And when they lost access to the tree of life, they therefore became subject to death because of sin.
Right.
So that statement by Paul doesn't require that they had been created immortal. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, you'd have to ask the question, why would it be that God would provide a tree of life for people who are already immortal?
Yeah.
And so you've got issues like that that suggest that people were created mortal. That's why it talks about being made from dust, because dust is the way to indicate their frailty and mortality.
So what does this mean, though, when we go to the text and it said that the day you eat of a fruit, you will die? Because a lot of opponents of the faith will say, yeah, and look, Adam lives 900 years after that. He does not die that day.
Right, and they're showing their misunderstanding of Hebrew. Mm-hmm. First of all, the phrase in the day is a Hebrew expression that means when. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean before the sun goes down. It doesn't mean sometime in the next 24 hours. Mm-hmm. It's a Hebrew expression for when. It's a temporal expression. Mm-hmm. So you can't say if it didn't happen in that day, then God lied, or that it must be spiritual death. Secondly, when we translate, you will surely die. Again, if you look at that expression elsewhere in the Bible, it always refers to being doomed to death or subject to death, mm-hmm. sentenced to death. Mm-hmm. It doesn't indicate that you're going to drop over dead immediately. Mm-hmm. It indicates that you are now under the sentence of death. So what God says is when you eat from the tree, you will come under sentence of death, doomed to die.
One example I'm thinking about, could we go to, I think it's 1 Kings 2, where David says to Shammah, who had cursed and said, if you ever leave our land and go elsewhere, the day you do that, you will die. And it's not as if Shammah goes out and as soon as he takes a step out there, he collapses right on the ground, but it's pretty much, you've signed your death warrant at this point.
Exactly.
Mm. Now, what we also see in your book is that what Adam and Eve did, we can look and say, how could Adam and Eve have done something so foolish, and yet we're doing the exact same thing Adam and Eve did every day?
Yes, we are. Mm. Sometimes we think the fall was they ate fruit they weren't supposed to eat, or the fall was they disobeyed. Now, mm-hmm. I'm not denying they did those two things, but that's not the fall. The fall is they wanted to be like God, and they took steps that they believed would gain that for them. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to be like God. What does it mean to be like God? Does it mean we want to be omnipotent? We want to be omniscient? Transcendent? No. They want to be like God pertaining to the issue of wisdom, because that's what the tree is. So they want to be wise, which, again, wisdom is connected with order. Mm-hmm. And God is the source of order, and God is the source of wisdom. Mm-hmm. All order is centered in God. All wisdom is centered in God. But they take it centered on themselves. They want to make themselves the source and center of wisdom and order. Mm-hmm. And that's the fall. And that's what we all still do. We all want to make it all about us.
Now, I'd like to move forward a little bit and talk about a part of the book that you actually didn't write some. And this part to me just thrilled me when I found out, because N.T. Wright is just one of my favorite scholars. I want to get my hands on pretty much anything he's written. I thought, oh my gosh, John Wharton and N.T. Wright together. Can things get any more awesome at this point? So N.T. Wright has a chapter in your book where he says, when Paul is talking about Adam, he's not really interested in making a case for the first human. He's more interested in talking about the effects of what happened with Adam.
Okay. The reason I got N.T. Wright to write that chapter is because if I wrote about Romans or Corinthians and said some things that people didn't traditionally think, everybody would say, what's Walton know about that? He's not a New Testament guy. Mm-hmm. So why should we take his word for it? So I wanted to partner with someone who would give a credible New Testament voice. Now, I liked the stuff that he wrote, but I'm certainly not in a position to defend the stuff that he wrote, because that's his chapter. But I like it, and I was very happy to have him participate in the book.
But we can say it is his basic idea that when we look at Paul talking about Adam in the epistles, he's not so much trying to say, hey, there was a historical figure, or hey, this is a first man. The main thing he wants us to get is, look what Adam did in comparison.
Yes, that is the point that Professor Wright is making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I had seen him make points about Adam and Eve possibly not being the only humans on certain videos of him speaking. It is a wonderful chapter, and it's wonderful that you two worked together on this enterprise.
I was very pleased.
Now, let's talk about a figure that's a little bit more important than Paul, and that would be Jesus as the keystone figure. So, Adam is in sacred space, and he screws it up. Jesus comes, and he's not exactly dwelling in sacred space, although he is dwelling in the land, which I suppose would be considered sacred space to some extent. But he's meant to make sacred space for us, isn't he?
Well, he is sacred space. Mm. I mean, the incarnation is about God's presence of mm-hmm. dwelling among his people.
Right.
So, I mean, my colleague Nick Perrin has his book, Jesus the Temple.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus is a temple. The Word became flesh and templed, tabernacled, dwelt among us.
Mm-hmm.
And so sacred space comes to earth in Emmanuel, God with us. And so, yeah, it's not just making sacred space, it's being sacred space.
Mm-hmm. And when we look at Jesus, then, as the new representative, he's coming in, and where Adam and Eve tried to establish wisdom on their own, he's establishing it on God's terms. And when he's doing miracles and things of that sort, he's really saying, this is what it's going to be like when God is in charge of this world.
He brings order.
Yeah.
He teaches wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
He shows us what living in the kingdom is like. And remember, Old Testament talks to us about living in the presence of God. That's the Torah.
Right.
That's the temple. That's God. Living in the presence of God.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus in the Gospels is talking an awful lot about living in the kingdom of God.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the same thing.
Right.
God among us.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, as he does all of his work, he's, of course, remember, he's the very image of God, and the image of God is the one who's involved in bringing about the order that God has ordained.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's bringing order in the actions that he does,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's calming the sea, whether it's driving out demons, whether it's curing illness, he is bringing order through the incarnation.
Yeah, this is something that N.T. Wright gets at also, when you talk about being in the presence of God, because N.T. Wright was one who really opened my eyes to this, that Jesus talks so much about the kingdom of God in the Gospels, and we hardly ever seem to talk about the kingdom of God in our sermons and our daily lives.
Yeah, isn't that strange?
Mm-hmm.
But again, we don't know what to do with the Old Testament either, and that's the same issue. The idea is that all of us are to be living the kingdom life,
mm-hmm.
living in the presence of God. Was it Brother Lawrence, you know, practicing the presence
yes.
of God, that we're just not, you know, not used to how that works.
Yeah, I was even talking to my father-in-law earlier this week and said, I wrote an article for the Christian Project, Alliance Equip magazine recently, and this is part of something that Warner Mischke said on my show when I interviewed him a few weeks ago. Well, this talks about how we just so approach the text from our modern perspectives and miss what the ancient text has to say. I said, I looked and I did a search for guilt in the New Testament. And I found when guilt shows up, it's not talking about some internal feeling. It's talking about a legal category, as if you have done something wrong. And when I looked up innocence, it's the exact opposite. It's not talking about internal feeling. It's talking about you have not done something wrong. And there are so many places where guilt and innocence are not mentioned, including the Epistle to the Romans. Many of the epistles, they never mention it. But then I said, then I looked up honor and shame. Honor and shame show up constantly. So why is it in our churches, I asked, we talk so much about guilt and innocence, we never say anything about honor and shame?
Yeah, we live in a different culture.
Mm. Now, when you're talking about the bringing of the order, here, this is also getting into the problem of evil, isn't it? That disorder really is a problem of evil for us today.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Could you expound on that some?
Yeah. Not quite sure what direction you'd like me to go with it. We usually think that we're living in a world of kind of a black and white, good and evil, right and wrong, and that we've got these two choices. That's what Job was dealing with, the fact that if bad happened to him, he must have done evil. Because if he was doing good, then good should happen. That's the retribution principle. Righteous prosper, wicked suffer. Black and white. And if we think of the world that way, we run into all kinds of trouble because we know people, you know, the Jobs among us, who are righteous, godly people, and yet who are suffering badly. And we say, well, what did they do wrong? And so we live in this world where we set up this dichotomy about good and evil. And what I found is that it looks to me like, especially in the book of Job, but you can see this in Genesis 2, it sets up a third category. That is that evil is what I'm now labeling disorder. Okay, it's moral in nature, and it's disorder. The good is that which is ordered, and that flows from who God is. Mm-hmm. And so you get order and disorder, but we've got this third category, non-order. Mm-hmm. Non-order is not evil. It's not something that's somehow demented or corrupt or something of that sort. It's just not yet having reached its full stage. Mm-hmm. So we could think of tornadoes or earthquakes as part of a non-order. Okay, mm-hmm. They're not evil. You know, there's nothing moral about a tornado. But likewise, we can't say that it's totally operating as a tool of God, as if He's sitting there with a remote control device guiding the tornado through the streets of the village to see who gets wiped out. And all those things are within the power of God, but He's not always using them to do His punishment or His reward or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And so when God talks to Job and says, you know, it rains where nobody lives, have you noticed that? That's talking about a non-order aspect. Yet mm-hmm. even in non-order, there's more order than we know. So it gives us a little bit different perspective on trying to work through the problem of evil.
You know, when you were talking about God's not sitting there guiding the tornadoes, I mean, He could do that if He wanted to sometimes. I mean, we'd say Sodom and Gomorrah was certainly a planned destruction.
Absolutely.
Somehow, but I can't but think of the Far Side comic where it's supposed to have God sitting at His computer and someone walking by a window and there's a piano tied to a string hanging above him and God's about to hit the key that says smite on the computer.
Yeah. Right.
And I'm thinking right now also about like when Hurricane Sandy took place and one of my friends contacted me and says, like, well, my brother or someone that she knew is going and saying that this is a judgment on God and we need to repent. What do you think about that? And said, I think it's not our call to make in that case. Jesus didn't even try and make that call in Luke 13 when He talked about disasters happening. He said, yeah, we don't know, but you know, either way, you might want to consider repenting and getting in line because you could be next.
Right. Mm-hmm. So what we should learn from it, not how we explain it.
Mm. Now, you also say we're subject to death because of disorder, not because of anything in our genes, such that if we do enough tampering with our genes, then, hey, we're going to live forever.
Yeah, no, that's certainly not a way that we would look at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anytime we try to talk about how does Adam's sin end up affecting all of us,
mm-hmm.
it's an important question, and it's certainly an interesting question, and it's one that theologians and philosophers have dealt with over the centuries, but mm-hmm. it's not one that the Bible gives an answer to.
Right.
As a result, whatever answer we give, however popular or innovative, either way it might be, we're guessing.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to make the best logical choice that we can.
Right.
And so, as a result, I mean, that's what theologians and philosophers do lots of times. They try to work out those issues in the best way possible. But that's not something that the Bible tells us how it works. The Bible's not going to tell us that it's genetic or that it's not genetic, because genetic isn't the category they have.
Yeah, and the Bible really doesn't tell us too much about pre-fall man, such that we can't know, like, how was his reasoning and how was his daily health and such. I mean, we could ask, could it be possible, for instance, for Adam and Eve to have made a mathematical mistake, or was that impossible before the fall? And those are interesting questions we can discuss, but we can't really know.
I'd much rather talk about what the Bible does teach and what it does claim, rather than us trying to fill in gaps that the Bible doesn't give us the basis to fill in.
Now, you do say that we're not all necessarily descended from Adam. That's not a necessity for what the Bible story, right?
That's true. Again, the Bible doesn't make a claim, in my understanding. The Bible does not make a claim like that. It attaches us all to Adam's sin. Mm-hmm. It attaches us to Adam as you could call it a federal head, as some theologians do, as the fountainhead of humanity. We're connected to Adam, but that doesn't mean that we are all biological genetic descendants of him.
Now, would we all, though, be biological genetic descendants of, say, the people who were on the ark?
Well, if you think that the only people who survived across the entire globe was Noah and his family, then you might come to that conclusion. Again, I'm not persuaded that's the view that the Bible claims. That's a whole other different issue.
Yeah, I did have someone else write me in asking some that I asked you as well. So we can just get this out here before we open. Is there any possibility we could see the lost world of Noah showing up sometime, Ben?
It's not really on my plans. There are people who have been talking to me about maybe thinking about it. I will need a lot of persuading at this point.
Well, I can certainly agree with the friend who wanted me to ask that and say, yeah, if you decide to do that, we're going to go ahead and pre-order our copies right now of that.
Well, you know, there's no doubt that there is a lost world of the flood.
Yeah.
Whether I found enough to make a book out of talking about it, I don't know. But you know, Lost World of Adam and Eve is actually out now. Amazon doesn't have it listed till March 27th, but it's in the warehouse at IVP, and the copies are going out. So it is available now.
Yeah, I have heard some people are already buying the Kindle editions. That's how some people were able to ask questions about it. Yeah, I definitely encourage people to go out and get it, and I'll go ahead and tell you, I'm looking on it right now on Amazon. It's a Kindle price. You can get it for $9.99. Paperback is $12.58. I'm somewhat surprised you got some used copies that you can get. Who's done with a book already and selling a used copy?
That's amazing.
Now,
Amazon still lists it as coming out on March 27th. And, of course, we're a lot earlier than that right now.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I think I saw and it said April 1st last I checked. Yeah, April 1st, 2010.
Wow.
Now, one final aspect from the book that we can discuss is a proposition that Adam and Eve are created as special, distinct creatures. Even if there was material continuity between them and someone came before, there is something distinct about Adam and Eve.
Sure. You know, in terms of distinguishing humans from non-humans, whether you call them chimpanzees or amoeba or Neanderthals, whatever, humans have aspects that differentiate them. One of those would be the image of God. The image of God is not something that's biological or genetic or neurological. It's not something material or physical. It's not something that you inherit or you grow. The image of God is something that God gives, and therefore that distinguishes us from animals. Of whatever level. The idea that we have a spiritual nature to us, whether you call that a soul or a spirit or a soul spirit or something else, that's for the philosophers to work out. But the fact is we as Christians believe that even once the biological organism of our bodies dies, that we continue to exist. And that's not something that can evolve. That's not something that's material or physical. Even though we intend to have resurrection bodies, that which is our spiritual self is something that distinguishes us from animals. Now, of course, we can have the discussion of whether that distinguishes us from Neanderthals for people who believe in those kinds of things, and talk about human beings who, you know, Homo sapiens who mated with Neanderthals in the genetic record. I'm out of my league.
Mm-hmm. But when we look to what that has to say for us today, I mean, we know that we weren't created in a garden or created and placed in a garden, but we can look at ourselves today and see that all of us are still part of that special distinct creation. We're all still meant to do what Adam was meant to do. Our job career hasn't changed.
Correct. We still are in God's image, all of us, every one of us, no matter what age, no matter what capability, no matter what mental state, no matter what education, no matter what gender or race, we're all in God's image, and therefore we have this task that God gave us as humanity. And so that's true of all of us. Again, all of us have a spiritual self. Mm-hmm. And so those are things that distinguish us. But again, they do make us different from animals.
And all of us are meant to imitate the great high priest who fulfilled the task perfectly.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, you have to say, for those of you listening, we have really gone through this book so much in depth today, but if you're sitting there thinking, okay, I've heard this interview, so I guess there's not really much need to get the book, I think you're mistaken on that point. I think this book is an excellent reference that you should have with you and you should take with you, and I mean, I'm pretty much reaching a point where it's kind of saying, yeah, I'm just waiting until the rest of the world finally catches up and realizes John Walton's right on Genesis 1, and then we can get past this whole debate on the age of the earth. Well, Dr. Walton, we're reaching that point of time, though, where unfortunately we do have to cut the conversation to a close. Do you have a blog or a website or any way that people can get in touch with you if they want to find out more?
Well, certainly if people want to contact me, they can do it through the Wheaton College website. Uh-huh. So it's just john.walton@wheaton.edu. Uh-huh. I don't have an active website per se. Uh-huh. I've got an Origins Today website, origins today.org, which is dealing with my lecturing and speaking ministry. And if people were interested in me coming to a church or a school and talking about these things, that would be a place where they could begin to make those arrangements.
Yeah, and I'm certainly looking forward to you coming to our own town next week to the UT Veritas Forum to talk about these kinds of issues.
Yep, I'm looking forward to it. Mm-hmm. And we'll have one, the Veritas Forum on Lost World of Scripture, mm-hmm. and then also another evening talking about the Genesis 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm. If there was a final message that you'd like to leave with a Deeper Waters audience today, what would that be?
It would be that we need to recognize that the war between Bible and science is fabricated.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly there are people who have beliefs that differ from one another. But in terms of science and the Bible being at war with one another, I think that's fabricated. That there is no war. The Bible's claims stand up, and that when we start reading the biblical text as the ancient document that it is, we'll find that it's not making scientific claims. That rather it's making very, very important theological claims. And that we have missed those claims to our disadvantage because we've been too busy trying to do the science thing. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have to go back to reading the text as the author wrote it, an ancient document in that language in that time, and the author's intentions should be our guide because that's what has authority.
Well, Dr. Walton, I'd like to thank you for giving us your time again, coming back here and discussing these important topics. And I hope whenever you get another book coming out, that we'll see you back here again.
Okay, Nick. Thanks for the chance to chat. It's always fun.
And I'd like to remind everyone that next week, Jerry Wall is beyond talking about his book, Heaven, Hell, and Purgatory. For now, I'm Nick Peters.